Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Program today, we have Derek Jensen from Northern California. And Derek is going to discuss how our Earth is being assaulted by the pervading Western myth in human supremacy. Derek has become one of the nation's leading voices of cultural and environmental dissent. He writes about civilization devastating the impact upon the environment and the natural world and our society's denial of that fact. UNT Reader listed Derek as among the 50 visionaries changing the world, in sharp contrast to environmental optimists who believe working within the corporate system will offset the tenuous planetary balance threatening us all. Derek has advocated for many years of a dismantling of civilization. We're curious what that means. He is the author of The Myth of Human Supremacy, and it is perhaps one of his most important works. His radio program, Resistance Radio, is on the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday evening at 6 o'clock, one of our most popular programs, and his website is Derek, that's D-E-R-R-I-C-K, Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N.org. Nice to have you with us today, Derek.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me again.
I'd like to focus on the myth that is ingrained into the DNA of our modern civilization and is unfortunately too often ignored or denied by the majority of people living in industrial and technological societies. It's the myth that underlies the entire capitalist agenda of infinite progress and development, but also found embedded in the major religions that have had an explicit role in the creation of capitalism in the 18th and 19th century. And that myth is that within the natural world, among the billions of organisms and animals and plants, microbes, humans rank supreme. It is the myth of human supremacy. And now we're witnessing this catastrophic effect on the Earth and perhaps the very survival of numerous species, including our own. So please define the human myth of supremacy and what have been its most visible consequences, like climate change, the rapid destruction of the environment, and the creation of polluted, contaminated ecosystems that are now unlivable for its original residents in nature. The forum is yours.
The ancient Greeks developed this idea of the scale of perfection or the great chain of being that held that there was a hierarchy that went from God at the top and then angels and then kings and then dukes and then they work their way down to merchants and then they get to peasants and then they get to and then women are, of course, below men, and then you keep going down through animals, plants, precious gems, and then sand, and how those at the top are primarily mind, and those, like God, is all mind, and those at the bottom are all body and no mind, and so humans are the ones who are really interesting in this because we have a body, but our minds are more important than our bodies, according to this idea. And we can just sort of laugh at this idea, but the truth is it pervades everything about us, and it pervades everything about how we relate to the world. And just a couple days ago, the Notre Dame burnt, which is horrible. It's an atrocity. It's heartbreaking. It's terrible. And it took hundreds of years to construct, and that is heartbreaking. But at the same time, 200 species went extinct that day, and all of those species, they took millions of years to construct. But because they were constructed by the natural world, that's not important. What we create, like if you ask people on the street to name three great pieces of art, they might say the Mona Lisa, the Sistine Chapel, and, you know, some other piece of art, Beethoven's Ninth. And how many of them would say Bird Song at Dawn, or Frog Song, or A Sunset, or Deciduous Forest in the Fall? That's not art because that was not created by humans. And or we think about all these inventions that who invented penicillin? I mean, I'm sorry, who invented antibiotics? And, well, you know, we can argue about Fleming, and we can argue about the people during the Crusades who would put moldy bread on their legs to on their wounds, to heal their wounds. So who invented it? Well, the truth is that some mold invented it. But when nature creates something, it doesn't count. You know, there's this great line by an astronomer. Oh, gosh, this was 5 or 6 years ago. Somebody was asking him why we need to explore Mars. And he said, to answer that most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? And when he said that, I just burst out laughing, because how can you ask if we're all alone when we're surrounded by all of this beautiful, sentient life? And, you know, if we had more than 20 minutes, we could talk about how plants communicate. We could talk about how bacteria speak a universal language that allows them to communicate antibiotic resistance across strains. We can talk about how extraordinary. We can talk about how in a forest they took trees in the undergrowth of a forest and or the understory of a forest, and they put them into a greenhouse, and they gave them the exact amount of light that they were receiving in the forest, and then they died. And they were trying to figure out why, and they figured out because other trees are, that there's nutrients running from other trees to them. Other trees are subsidizing them, feeding them through networks of mycelia, fungi, fungal networks. And, I mean, the whole world is so beautiful and amazing, and this culture has this idea that the only things that count are what we create. And this manifests all through, all through this culture from top to bottom, from inside to out. And I didn't know that you were going to ask me about the myth of human supremacy. I thought, and this is great you did, I thought you were going to ask me about, Earth Day. And what I was going to say, what I'm going to say now that has to do with this whole myth of human supremacy is that what I want for Earth Day is a resurrection of the older environmental movement. Because at one point, the environmental movement was more about saving wild places and wild beings. And grassroots environmentalists are still about this. But a lot of the mainstream environmental movement has been converted entirely away from saving wild places and wild beings and into saving this destructive culture. And I blame the climate change movement for a lot of this. You can have 100,000 people march on the streets of New York City or Paris or Washington, D.C., and if you ask the individual, I'm not blaming the individuals, if you ask the individuals, why are you marching? They're saying to save the planet. But if you ask them, what do you want, like what are your specific demands, their specific demands are, we want subsidies for the solar and wind industries. And that's extraordinary. Can you think of any other social movement, mass social movement, that has been pretty much part and parcel converted into a lobbying arm for a specific sector of the industrial capitalist economy? It's like taking the entire anti-war movement and making it into a lobbying arm for an industry, or the entire animal rights movement and turning that into a specific lobbying arm for a specific set of the industry. It's crazy, and it comes back to this notion and that a lot of the sort of mainstream environmentalists, they don't hide the fact that if you ask them what are they trying to protect, they don't say they're trying to protect polar bears. They don't say they're trying to protect migratory songbirds. They say they're trying to protect civilization. They're trying to protect this way of life. And so I'm going to say one more thing, and then you can go with another question or whatever. The one more thing I want to add is that there have been very few interviews that I have done for Resistance Radio that have not aired, because most of them, the people I've talked to have just been great. But one of them, I didn't air because I disagreed with the person so much. And the interview was about a river, and this river no longer reaches the ocean. And one of the things that this environmentalist kept saying over and over is that she wanted to debunk the notion that there is not enough water for everybody. She said there's enough water for the farmers and the fish and for everybody to have all the water they want from this river. And I was just screaming inside thinking, if that's the case, why are the fish going extinct? And why does the river no longer reach the ocean? One of the most destructive myths that we have in this culture is the notion that we can have it all. That we can, I love this line by John Livingston. He says, there is no surplus in nature. That if you take a salmon to eat, or if you take, it doesn't matter, if you take anything out of that natural community, that's somebody else's food. And that doesn't mean that humans can never eat anything. Obviously, we have to eat something. But the point is that the salmon on the Columbia River were in trouble before the dams. The salmon in the Columbia River were first in trouble because of the canneries, because no population, not even one as big as passenger pigeons, as big as salmon, as big as anything else, can survive the infinite demand of a global economy. And one more example of this, that this woman wrote to me probably 12 or 13 years ago saying that she lived in Canada and there were lots and lots of grizzly bears in the valley where she lived. And then over a period of 3 or 4 years, the grizzly bears all disappeared. Why did they disappear? Because hunters discovered the market for gallbladders, bear gallbladders in China. And so my point is that even something as esoteric as bear gallbladders cannot survive the demands of an infinite global economy. And so if I were to have one wish for Earth Day, it would be that we remember that our loyalty is and must be to life on the only planet that we know of in the universe that has life on it. And our loyalty must be transferred away from the economy and toward those, the natural world. And that doesn't mean that you can't ever participate in the economy at all. You know, I had thrown at me a lot back when I was writing Endgame, the whole Buddhist notion of non-attachment. And a lot of people would say, you know, Derek, you're just too attached to the salmon. You need to let them go. And this always made me really mad. And I couldn't figure out why until a few years later I was driving a car. And I thought, no, it's not that you shouldn't be attached to the salmon. It's that we need to not be attached to industrial civilization. We need to not be attached to our car. Sure, we can drive a car, but or we can go to the grocery store. But that's not where our loyalty needs to be. Our loyalty needs to be with the natural world, with the living planet that is our only home.
Well said, Derek. I appreciate that. You've expressed criticism against the scientific community now labeling the age we live in as the Anthropocene, which implies that we are now living in the age of man or humanity, and that humanity has reached a kind of ascension above everything else. Why should this term threaten us in the natural world, and how might we perceive this age we live in differently?
I prefer to call this a sociopathy, because it's the age of sociopaths, because you really have to be a sociopath to be able to hear stolid scientists saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish within 35 years now, and to not tear your hair out and to not act to defend that. You know, as my dear friend Lear Keith often says, love is a verb. And if you love something, you act to defend it. And this is one of the reasons that I agreed to be on PRN in the first place, and one of the reasons that I've always loved being interviewed by you, and one of the reasons that I've so respected you and still respect you, is that you are very clear about your love for non-human animals and your love for and your desire to stop injustices. And there are places where you and I agree completely and places you and I disagree. But I don't actually care. What I care about is that your loyalty is so clear and so strong, and you've also gotten off your butt and done something. You found that there were these beings and communities under assault, and you got off your behind and you did something about it. Just like my friend Deanna Meyer, she loves prairie dogs, and the prairie dogs are under assault. And so instead of just complaining, oh my gosh, the prairie dogs are under assault, she started doing whatever it takes to protect them. And so I don't know where I was going with that, just that I think it's that as this world is under assault, I think that we need to recognize that whether or not the individual leaders are sociopaths, I actually don't care whether the Clintons were sociopaths or whether Trump is a sociopath or whether any of the individuals are. What I care profoundly about is that we have an entire system that rewards sociopathic behavior. You know, I don't remember who it was who wrote a really good book. I can't remember his name right now. He wrote a really good book a few years ago comparing corporations to sociopaths and just saying how it fits all down the line, that there's absolutely no emotional attachment, there's no emotional connection, and instead you have merely a drive for power, a drive for acquisition, and we have a system that rewards that sort of behavior, and that sort of behavior needs to be stopped. And I wish that we had the time to have a voluntary transformation where, you know, we change our stories slowly, and over several generations we grow to understand that this is not a good way. I don't want to say that. I was going to say it's not a good way to organize a society, but it is a good way to organize a society if what you're after is the continuous accumulation of wealth at the expense of everybody else on the planet. And for that, it's a fine and dandy way. But if you want to continue life on the planet, which, you know, people have asked me a couple times how I could summarize all of my books into just a couple sentences. And it would be this, that this way of life cannot continue forever. And when it's done, I would prefer that there is more life on this planet rather than less. That's it. That's all of my analysis from all 25 books into, I guess, one sentence with a semicolon.
You've been listening to Derek Jensen on our Earth Day special. Jesse, we're going to continue this we'll do the wrap-up for BAI, but I'm going to continue this Progressive Radio Network.
We're going to have to do it for the archives, so we'll keep the rest for the archives.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Yes, so I'm going to continue because I've got several more questions to ask him, all right?
Okay.
So this will play Tuesday night. All right, so we're going to continue now. Why is it so difficult?
Jesse, can you send me a note letting me know when it's going to air so I can publicize it?
Yep, will do, Derek.
Okay, thanks.
Tuesday evening on the Progressive Commentary Hour.
We have Abby Martin we have to play.
Oh, okay, then the following Tuesday.
Yeah.
Okay. Derek, why is it so difficult for humans to observe and accept that other species, and perhaps even trees, as you mentioned earlier, and plants, based on the most recent science, are endowed with self-awareness? And it may not be consciousness as humans typically understand it, but no one asks whether consciousness might be more than one definition, and therefore our entire view of the Earth and everything that lives on it is framed in the language of anthropomorphism, which is this view of life erroneously, and especially in light of the larger body of scientific research that has been conducted that shows that humans are not alone in being endowed with self-awareness intelligence. And then what does this say about the fallacy of our definition of self-awareness and intelligence?
Well, thank you for all these great questions. And this one, I'm going to go a couple directions. One of them is that I love the line by Upton Sinclair, "It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it." And I would alter that a little bit to be, "It's hard to make anyone understand something when," or "It's hard to make people understand something when their privileges and the benefits they receive from it are based on them not understanding it." So we have tremendous social rewards for us to not believe that a hog in a factory farm is suffering. And we have a tremendous social reward system set up for us to not believe that trees scream when they fall, that trees have neighbors, that trees have relationships. And we have tremendous social rewards not to believe that. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And you're going to make a lot more money than if you look at trees and you see neighbors. That's part of the social reward system. And so that was one part. And another is that it's so funny when you start to talk about trees being intelligent or hogs being intelligent, or it doesn't matter, bacteria being, it doesn't matter. If you start to speak about anybody but non-humans being intelligent, you immediately get accused of anthropomorphizing, of projecting human characteristics onto non-humans. Well, that's presuming that intelligence is a human perspective only. So as projecting as opposed to recognizing, that's really interesting language. But also, it's still really narcissistic in that it presumes always, all the tests they do for whether a non-human is intelligent are predicated on us comparing their behavior to human intelligence, as opposed to shark intelligence being an entirely different thing, or bacteria intelligence being an entirely different thing, based on its own circumstances and what serves it well. And even on the level of what serves, even on the level of looking at this from the perspective of, you know, sort of basing on human intelligence, I just read this thing the other day about how sharks will leave an area as soon as orcas show up, and they'll stay away for as long as a year. And I was really pleased to read this because it reminded me of something that I've heard before, which is that, I mean, fish are not unintelligent at all. And if a fish sees a predator in a certain spot, okay, there's a road that I drive every couple months over to Medford from Crescent City, Medford, Oregon to Crescent City, California. And there's a spot where one time, 7 or 8 years ago, I saw a cop sitting with a radar gun. Every time I drive by there, I make sure to this day that I'm not speeding because I still remember that guy. And the point is that fish do the same thing. If they're swimming somewhere and they see a predator, they will avoid that place. And people love to talk about it. I mean, you could look up killing machine and shark, and I don't have a computer here, but I'm guessing that if you did a search for that, you would find millions and millions of hits for that description of sharks. But they're not killing machines. First off, they mainly scavenge. But second, and what's most important, is that they're not machines. I mean, talk about anthropomorphization. You're really projecting, not you, one is really projecting. When they talk about ecosystems instead of natural communities, when they talk about a mechanistic view of the natural world, that's projecting a creation of humans onto the natural world as opposed to a natural community. Anyway, it just tickled me to learn that sharks, as soon as they see the big predator who can eat them come around, like, that's a thought process. It's like, hey, maybe if we stick around here, you know, it's basically, if we stick around here, we could get killed, so let's leave for a while. That certainly shows, you know, there's a great definition of intelligence, which is, how's it go? It is basically, I can't remember how it goes, but it's basically how you're able to act now to project positive outcomes into the future. And first, sharks are obviously showing it right there when they leave, when orcas show up. And second, the evidence that this culture is killing the planet and killing this planet's ability even to support humans is all over the place. And you have people from Richard Dawkins to Bill McKibben saying that humans could go extinct fairly soon, and yet we don't question this way of life. We can more easily see ourselves going extinct than we can see changing this way of life. That's not very smart.
Let me give you a few examples, Derek, and see what you make of them. I was only 22 years old when I came to New York City, and on the corner where I lived a block away, there was a chimpanzee in the window. And one day, as I'm running to go into Riverside Park to do my morning workout, the man knocked on the window, and I stopped, and he said, come around the door. So I went around the door. He says, hi. He said, I see you running every morning here, and he said, I've got to lose some weight. He said, could you give me some pointers? And I said, sure. So each day for the next week, he came out, and I showed him how to get into shape. And in the interim, he had invited me into his house, and he had a chimpanzee who was called Kokomo Jr. and used to appear on the old Dave Garraway show on NBC in the morning show, Good Morning show there. And he told me that, you know, this was a chimpanzee, and I said, what is that on her back? And it turns out it looked like a plate, a metal plate, and, oh, that's to keep her obedient. If she acts out in any way, I just push this button, and it throws a little electric shock and stops her. Well, we became friends, and I would go over there in the morning since I was a writer, and I was interested in studying this, and I wrote a manuscript called From Instinct to Intellect, A Study of Primates. And there were several occasions when he would go away for a day or two and ask, would I take care of her? And she had her this caged area, and here were the food. So I said, fine, but I didn't give her the food that he suggested. I was giving her a wide variety of fruits and vegetables. And she was timid, but I took off her halter, and I showed it to her, and I put it aside. The moment I did that, she came up and hugged me.
Oh, my gosh.
And then we would sit, and I would teach her. She ended up learning 167 words and expressions. And where we could communicate, she would tell me what kind of movie she wanted to watch and what kind of pictures she liked in books, which food she liked better than the others. And I treated her completely differently than her owner did. And then that went on for about 4 years, and then he left and moved down to North Carolina. And he said that when they get to a certain size, they can't be controlled, so they all go to live on this island with all these other older, retired chimpanzees. And I didn't know it that, if you remember Cheetah in the Tarzan films, she was still alive to a few years ago. She lived like 80 years old. Now, jump ahead. I've had an animal sanctuary for 50 years. And I take in abandoned and damaged and beaten animals, and I get them back to love and health and then find them a permanent loving home. At least those that I can. There's some I can't. They have to be, you know, with me the rest of their life because they would not survive in certain environments. But I'll give you an example of what happens when you give love and you're communicating at the level the animal communicates at. There's a cat named Sally, and Cat is the love of all the animals on the property. So she goes over by each of their enclosures each day, and they pet her and groom her, and then she goes to another one for another half hour, and they get great joy out of doing this. So one day she walked by one of the enclosures where one of the capuchin monkeys named Buddha, and he didn't get the groomer. So he immediately ran up and he got some food and he threw some food at her and she sniffed it and she didn't like it. So he went back, got other food. So he kept throwing food at her until finally she liked one of the little monkey bars and she ate the monkey bar. Then he threw the food, but not to her, but about 10 feet away, then 3 feet away, then 2 feet away. And then he hand fed her while he petted her. I'm sitting there watching this and thinking, what kind of intelligence did it take for him to realize that if he wanted her to come over, he had to give something to her that would entice her over? Also, I've seen what happens when you're sad. The animals will hug you. They know that you're suffering, and they hug you. As a result, I've had a lot of people who've been homeless. I've taken in over 480 homeless people in my life and gave them a place to live and food and help them reacclimate to get back into the world. And they're all suffering from some form of post-traumatic stress disorder, including former vets. But just being able to hug an animal, dogs, cats, horses, monkeys, and then that brings them right up. It brings their energy up. And people don't understand the nature of a bond, yet a person will know that their dog or cat has a special relationship, understands their moods. And the new science shows that these sentient beings understand our moods. They can read our moods. They can reflect upon the intonations in our voice, the cadence of our words, the level of our communicating, whether we're laughing and singing or whether we're frowning and angry. And they respond physically. So when you see how smart these animals are, and what they do relate to is love. I'll give you one more example. There was two fellas in England who were given a baby lion cub that had been rejected by its mother, and they raised it, and they had a large estate until it was too large, and the community said that you can't keep a large lion. And so they personally took it to Africa to a large game preserve and let it go. 7 years go by. They want to see if they can find it. They don't know if it's still alive. So they get a person that takes them to the area. And after a day, there's their lion up on this little cliff area. Well, now the lion sees him, comes running down, and jumps up on him, starts loving him. I mean, and the lion's fully grown now, right? 700 pounds. And is just, and now here's what's interesting. The lion not only identified with him immediately, but remember, to the lion, that's his mother, right? The two guys were his mother. So you're watching this, and suddenly you see the rest of the pride come down. Mind you, these are wild lions, right? And they don't have any bond with you. And yet, they came right over, they were sniffing the guys, didn't bite them, were non-aggressive. So that shows you the interspecies ability to communicate. You're talking about trees communicating with root systems. Animals communicate as well, and that was phenomenal. And finally, I posted on my Facebook this animal whisperer. This animal whisperer, I'm guessing she was about 6 years old, and she's in the wilds. And it's obvious that her father is filming this, and she's running, and she runs up to a leopard. These are wild animals, not tame. And she starts petting the leopard. And the leopard's letting her pet him. And then she walks, and the leopard walks with her. And then she comes to a giant bull elephant, and she goes over and hugs the bull elephant's leg. And then the elephant puts his nose up to her face, and then she climbs up his trunk and rides around with him for a half hour. And then he goes to an elephant watering hole, and must be 30 other elephants there. So she gets down and starts hugging them all, including other bull elephants. Then she has hyenas and then a pride of lions. And they're all treating her like she is one of their babies. Now, you don't want people to do that, but what you learn from that is that at the level of consciousness that the animal has, and also their spiritual consciousness, that they're communicating in ways that are limited vocabulary and limited understanding of interspecies communication allows. So these are the phenomena that allow you to love nature and love all of its beings. And when you see sea lions diving off cliffs now, and there's a video of it, it's horrible to watch. Oh, my God, it's horrible. It's 250 feet that they're dying, hundreds of them. They're diving off a cliff and crashing and dying because of global warming. So to your comment about when you disrupt one species in one area, thinking that it's not important, it is. Your thoughts on this, please.
I think I have... I don't watch very many nature programs, and one reason for that is that every time they show a spider, it's killing a fly. Every time they show an alligator, it's killing a gazelle. And yes, predators do exist, and predators kill prey. In no way am I suggesting they don't. Of course they do, and that's part of life. But an alligator eats like once a month, and it spends most of its time doing other things. And another way to think about this is that prior to the conquest of the area where I live by the Europeans, there were a lot of grizzly bears here. And in fact, there were so many grizzly bears that if you were by a river, you would probably see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes, which means seeing a grizzly bear would be about as noteworthy as, I don't know, seeing a red car, you know, seeing somebody wearing a hat. You know, it's like, the point is that humans lived where I live now for at least 12,000 years, according to carbon dating, without trashing the place, and they lived in, they lived as neighbors with grizzly bears, and this culture has been in this place for 180 years, and the place is getting pretty trashed. And again, I'm not arguing, and I don't think you're arguing, that we should send little children out to pet leopards. But I think the world, we've been taught that the world is red in tooth and claw, and that it's nasty, and that life is nasty, brutish, and short. But again, if you're seeing a grizzly bear every 15 minutes, that means that, I mean, okay, where I live right now, there's no grizzly bears. I haven't been grizzly bears for quite a while, but there's black bears, and I see them almost every day. And people have said, oh my gosh, doesn't that make you afraid to walk into the forest? And I say, no, not at all, because there's one person dies in North America every 2 years from a black bear attack. And on the other hand, there's like 35,000 people die every year because of automobile accidents. And so we're afraid of some of the wrong things. I knew this woman a couple, three decades ago who taught at a preschool. And one day she took the children, it was in a city, and she took the children to a botanical garden. And the children were all terrified of... they saw a butterfly and they ran away, afraid it was going to sting them. And my point is that these little children had never seen a butterfly, and they were taught to be afraid of everything in nature. And that's horrifying. That, you know, the bumblebees have come out here, and just yesterday I was walking past some huckleberry bushes, and they were buzzing with bumblebees, and it's just a beautiful, wonderful sound. And nature is not... Well, I was going to say nature's not out to get us, but of course, you know, nobody leaves us alive. And, of course, in the end, that's part of the deal, is that you're born, and then you live this wonderful life, and then you die, and then someone else is going to eat you at that point. You become food for someone else. I want to tell a story real quick that I've never told on your show. It's very interesting to me. I was sitting... 13, 14 years ago now, and I was sitting by a pond with two dogs and three cats, and a rat started walking up to us, and the dogs immediately bolted after the rat, and I called stop, stop, and they did, and then the rat jumped into the pond, swam across the pond, and when it got out on the other side of the pond, I suddenly saw that this rat could barely walk, and I realized that I had in this case done a bad thing by stopping it, because why would a rat walk up to two dogs and three cats and a big ape? Because it was really sick and it was time for it to die. And I first understood that a little bit when I read Barry Lopez's Of Wolves and Men, where he talks about the conversation of death, where you can have wolves. How do wolves know which of the deer or which of the elk to take? And a lot of times there is this exchange. So I just 2 days ago had to take a cat in to put her down because she was old. I rescued her when she was, I don't know how old she was. She was already old, and then I had her for several years. And she was dying of kidney failure. And she was so miserable at the end. And I think for me, that's a place that predation does obviously play a role, is in nature. She would not have gotten to where, I mean, I left her too long, as we so often do, and I was petting her on my lap, but at the end, she couldn't use her back legs, and that wouldn't happen in nature, because when she got to that point, somebody would put her down quick. I don't know where I'm going with this. I guess I'm just going to...
Okay, I've got another
please,
area for you to go
ahead.
Our final area, and this is going to be a little disjointed, but it's all interconnected when we stand back far enough from it. And that is, we have people running environmental groups today who are doing absolutely nothing to stop the destruction of our environment. They're not examples of personal change themselves. They make big salaries, and therefore they claim to care, and frequently taking money from the very industries that are polluting, that kind of sociopathic model that you discussed earlier. On the other hand, we have younger people like Cortez, the representative, who says, we want a Green New Deal, and yet when you look at the Green New Deal, they're supporting nuclear radiation and nuclear plants because they haven't thought through, and nor are they expert themselves on what it means to have renewable energy, like wave power that we don't use at all, a geothermal we don't use at all, though we have lots of geothermal in the United States. And we're also not breaking up the big farms to create smaller, sustainable organic farms and nurturing the earth and the worms and people being able to get fresher produce without the carbon footprint. So just about everything that those of us who've been in the old environmental movement have seen works, they are disconnected from because they've never really spent quality time in nature. They've never taken the time with no cell phones and no staff and no people just to take a week and spend around those trees and looking at streams and walking in the pristine, pure air of a mountain area. So they're telling us what we should do, and the trouble is it's all political. None of it's going to happen. And why is none of it going to happen? Now, this brings me to the last part of I have spent my life trying to share with people to facilitate the changes that they say they're willing to make, if only they had the information. Okay. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, the Buddhist concept of lack of attachment, I put it on the table and walk away. What they use, how they use it, is their business. And I coined a term about a year and a half ago called intentional neglect. And if we engage in intentional neglect from intentional ignorance, we can then say, I didn't know. I didn't know that vaccines were dangerous. I didn't know that eating non-organic food was bad. I didn't know smoking was bad. I didn't know that living in over-congested areas like Manhattan or Los Angeles or San Francisco was bad. So they can do this with anything, and just as easily they could say, I intentionally know. So then they go after a topic because they want to know the truth, because they're at that point in their life, they're willing to make changes if they find that they can. Now, I took a look, and I asked some simple questions. How many people, organizations, groups, states, federal government, agencies, how many in the United States are actually engaged on a regular basis of making life better for the planet and for each other? Then I took 40 areas like banking and agriculture and renewable energy. I took pharmaceutical industry, the medical industrial complex, the educational system, every single one of the systems that we have to live through, go through at different parts in our life. I couldn't find one that was doing it authentically. Everything has been corporatized, commodified, and then the extension of that is this. The only time we ever change in life is either because of direct, dire consequences if we don't, or we have a heart attack or a stroke, or we have cancer and suddenly we're going to change, or we get divorced, or we go bankrupt, or there's a crisis, environmental crisis, because we didn't move. We're living in a non-sustainable area. And then the crisis forces us into that moment of reckoning. What role did my hubris, inertia, play in the consequence of this to me? Just like the orca creates an environment that is inhospitable to lesser predatory creatures, including white sharks, great white sharks, and lesser sharks than that. So you adjust to your environment. And what we've done, we've maladapted to virtually everything in our life. We maladapt to a corrupt two-party system. We maladapt to high interest rates. And yet we'll watch Samuel Jackson excoriate that we're going to get 2% back. Yeah, but the other side of that is we're paying 18% interest on a credit card. So if they give us back 2%, we're still out 16%. Did we need the item we were buying in any case? So all of the inducements are false. Everybody has to have an advanced education. Well, why not today, with 55% of all college students not being able to find a job in the area they went to college and having enormous debt, why don't we suggest trade schools where you can actually learn something you could apply in the real world? And we're not doing that. Instead, we keep the same old mantra going. And so I'm interested in the fact that most people are not going to change anything. The professional class of 71 million scientists, engineers, educated people, doctors, lawyers, they're not going to change. Their family's not going to change because they've gotten used to as much stuff as they can consume, they want more. So where is the inclination at the spiritual level, the intellectual level, the emotional level, say, you know something? I don't need this meat-based diet. I don't need to live in this congested city. I don't need to have all these artificial trappings of what's supposed to make me happy, because everything I put into making myself happy, none of it's made me happy. Maybe I should change. So if these policymakers and opinion leaders are not behind an environmental revolution, then who is left to do that? And I just don't see this having a good outcome. I see that we will go into that long night, which is getting shorter, sleepwalking and immune at the emotional level to the consequences of our actions. Your final thoughts, please.
I agree with what you're saying, and every cell in my body wants for reasoned discourse and facts to win the day. But I think that when facts run up against people's vested interests, facts lose. And I think also when facts run up against people's neuroses or psychoses, or I'm not attacking anybody else with this. When facts run up against my own PTSD or my own other issues, facts have a hard time breaking their way through. It takes a lot of work to try to change, and a lot of people don't want to put in that work, and especially when they're socially rewarded for not doing it. And so I too do not have a lot of optimism. I remember reading that Lewis Mumford wanted to have on his grave that here lies the biggest idiot of all time, and he was wrong about everything he wrote when he talked about this culture destroying everything. But, of course, that's not come to pass. And I know you know this, and I know this, but I think it's really important to say as well that even though we're not particularly optimistic, that doesn't alter the fact that we need to do the work. Because if there is a 1/1 millionth, the stakes are so high that if there is a 1/1 millionth of 1% chance that anything you do or I do makes a difference for the real world, then we need to do it. And this is true not just for you, not just for me. It's true for Deanna Meyer, whom I mentioned earlier about the prairie dogs. And so it's like again, my friend Lear Keith often says that if there's anybody alive left in 100 years, they're going to ask, what was wrong with us that we didn't fight like hell when the world was going down? And now is the time to fight. Now is the time to get up and find what you love. And whatever it is you love, whether it's discourse, whether it is women, whether it is prairie dogs, whether it is factory-farmed hogs, it doesn't matter. Whatever you love is under assault, so get up and defend whatever it is you love.
I appreciate those insights. Let me just close out with these thoughts. I am both an optimist eternally, but I'm also a critical thinker in that I spend a great deal of my time alone involved in study and scholarship. And I see for those of us who are aware, who literally are conscious of the cause and effect of everything happening on the planet at this moment, that we can mitigate the circumstances to us individually. You are correct, none of us get out of this place alive, but the quality of our character, the meaning of the legacy that we have left, not one of building mansions and collecting wealth or how many friends we have, but rather how we touched the people that we did interface with. We were kind, empathetic. Did we help those who could have used our help, but we were too busy to walk and we walked by them? Or did we stop and say, friend, tell me your story, and see what within our means we could do to make a difference? And those people are not a few. I'm imagining them to be around about 7% of the American population, higher percentages in other cultures around the world, especially the indigenous cultures, like the Bushmen of the Kalahari, that always bury ostrich eggs filled with water for the next people that they will never meet, but knowing that they will care. Like Krishnamurti, the great Indian sage, said, I will pick the pebble up, not that I would have stepped on, but to prevent the person behind me that I will never see from stepping on. That type of consciousness allows a person to live as close as they can and most reasonably in balance with nature. And so if you look at 7% of the population, right now we're about 333 million people, that's still about 23 million people, more or less. That's a lot of people. That's more than live in Los Angeles, New York City, and Chicago combined. That's not an insignificant number. What is important is that we begin to look for intentional communities, places where people of a like mind can live and work and engage in a different type of lifestyle, one that's not predicated upon how much money you make, how much you achieve, your degrees, your social standing, the deference to people will have to you because of your accomplishment. Rather, what you offer is a spiritual, sentient being as well. And there was a time when that was the way we did live. That's what allowed society to exist, as you said, for 12,000 years in your community. And yet they had to close down Yellowstone Park this year because when there was a strike, the people couldn't even take care of their own mess. They were defecating everywhere, putting garbage everywhere. So I believe that the future is bright in the sense that we can extend the quality of life on this planet by understanding the relationship we should have to everything on this planet. And so I'm supportive of that. And therefore, for the rest of humanity, I'm afraid that they will end up seeing so many disasters with currency collapses and the economy overloaded with debt and the environmental cascading of tipping points and the disease rates increasing, suicide rates increasing, separation, loneliness, the body politic of identity politics and opportunists and sociopaths at every juncture trying to capture, even profiting off people's misery and poverty. I don't see a happy outcome for them. Your final thought?
Well, what you said say makes a lot of sense. And I guess my final thoughts are that, again, once you've transferred your loyalty away from the system that's killing the planet toward the natural world, then the next step is to figure out a way to do something and start by just committing an hour or two a week. Take an hour or two that you're not going to watch television or that you're not going to play a computer game, and instead devote that to, you know, just starting. The way I got started forever ago, back in my 20s, was I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline. I wasn't covering the social and ecological costs. So I said, okay, for every dollar I spend on gas, I'm going to give a dollar to a local environmental organization. But I didn't have any money. So what I would do is I'd pay myself $5 an hour. So if I spent $10 on gas, that means I would spend 2 hours that week writing a letter to the editor, or pretty soon I was doing anti-circus demos and then anti-fur demos. And I moved from there to doing timber sale appeals. And pretty quickly, at first it was like, okay, I'm just going to do, I spend $15, I'm doing 3 hours this week, and no excuses at all. And then once I started doing it, I only did this for like a couple, 3 months before I quit keeping track, because I was having so much fun with the activism. So just find some way to get yourself started, and then once you get yourself started, you'll find there's a momentum that just carries you on. So that's for me, the most important thing is to make your loyalty to the natural world, and the second most important thing is, once you've done that, to get off your behind and do something.
I agree. We are, at the end of the day, what we do, not just what we say. Thank you very much for being with us today, Derek. Continuing with our series of conversations with remarkable minds, how our Earth is being assaulted by the pervading Western myth in human supremacy, is Derek Jensen. And again, Derek's email address, or the way to reach him, is Derek, D-E-R-R-I-C-K, Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N.org, and he is the author of The Myth of Human Supremacy. All the best to you, Derek, and I want to thank
you. Well, thank you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not